Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, our religious belief is not private, it's public. A leading US Archbishop tells us how we need to be both joyful and bold in sharing our faith. All people have a right to education. A Pakistani bishop comments on the recent shooting of a Pakistani girl by Taliban militants and expresses support for her campaign for girls' education. And spotlight on new saints. We take a closer look at two women from North America who will be proclaimed saints by Pope Benedict at this Sunday's canonization ceremony in the Vatican. Here in the Vatican, the ongoing Synod of Bishops on the new evangelization is more than halfway through its work. And the dominant and recurring themes raised by the participants have become more apparent. Among those attending the three-week synod is Archbishop Joseph Kurtz of Louisville, Vice President of the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Conference. I caught up with him during a coffee break to find out more about the main issues emerging during the interventions by the synod participants. Archbishop Kurtz told me that our religious belief is personal, but it's not private, it's public, and says we need to be both joyful and bold in sharing our faith.
Well, there are some very obvious challenges. One of the first one is the great diversity of people. We're bringing together bishops and other delegates from five continents. So imagine the great richness, both of experiences, but also of challenges. Secondly, there is, I think, the general challenge within, a world that is tempted to turn in on itself, a world that that tends to care for itself. It's difficult in those circumstances to announce the good news of Jesus Christ. So there are new ways that are required for us to reach out and to announce to others the good news of Jesus Christ. That will take, first of all, our own inner conversion, because we know that any words we speak, if they're not matched by a witness of a joyful life, will not be attractive. And so it is a challenge, I guess, primarily of inner conversion, as we are asked, the documents tell us, to be bold, as we are asked to be both joyful and bold. Now, that's a good combination, I would say.
A lot of people, though, are not bold, are they? Some people are actually quite embarrassed almost to announce that they're Christian, because there is this feeling that religious belief in the West is somewhat marginalized, pushed to one side, not allowed to occupy the public sphere.
Yeah, there's a temptation. There's a temptation to consider our religion private. And I'd like to say that first of all, our religious belief is personal, but it is not private, it's public. And it is true that we are always looking for ways to allow people to, in a sense, express their view publicly. One of the introductions I made was the blessing of the child in the womb. And this blessing is meant to be a first evangelization, obviously, for the child in the womb, but a new evangelization for the family. And I did focus groups back in Kentucky. And when I would ask people at the beginning of the focus groups, what would it take for them to share their faith, there was great hesitation. Then at the end, I said to them, let me tell you about this blessing of the child in the womb that was just approved for use in the United States. And to a person, they said, oh, I could tell my niece, or I could tell my friend, I could invite them to a blessing. So I think part of it is something that people believe would be within their reach.
In a much quoted remark, the Archbishop of Washington, Donald Wilt, spoke of a tsunami of secular influence sweeping across the Western society. Do you find a lot of evidence of that in your own archdiocese?
Well, I think it's a vivid image. And certainly, I think anyone who tries to live a life for others understands how tempting it is to turn in on oneself. I think what I had said earlier, an example that I use that I think strikes home is one of the bishops in our small group said that in a card that was to celebrate, if you would, Christmas, the feast in which the Son of God, love outpoured, comes among us, had this description. It said, "Happy holiday. Do something nice for yourself." Well, now that's obviously a very pleasant sentiment, but it is completely turning us inward. And I think, in a sense, a tsunami, but perhaps a tsunami that's somewhat gentle in the way it enters our lives.
Are some of the delegates from the developing countries, where there is still very often a stronger sense of religiosity, do they have any suggestions as to what we in the West maybe are doing wrong?
Well, I'm not sure. What I have found is that people from the various continents are intrigued as they bring, first of all, their own sentiments, because let's face it, every one of us brings both joys and also opportunities, but also great challenges. I think especially if some of the interventions that were made by bishops and other delegates from Africa, and I think they wonder, is this, let's say, falling off of the public practice of the faith, something that will, in a sense, be touching their lives. I guess there's that tsunami image again. So I think there's more curiosity and some wariness rather than the desire to give a recipe for what works in one place in the hope that it'll work in another. So I think in many ways there's, the word I would give would be solidarity. I think there's a great desire for us to work as one church. And boy, is that ever encouraging.
Okay, we're now more than halfway through this synod. What are some of the most striking or interesting proposals or ideas that you've heard in this synod that have really struck a chord with you?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're at the level of proposal, because I think that is the second part, and I think it's a very studied approach. Here I'm talking as if I've been at many synods. This is my first, so I'm going only on the experience of others. But I would say there are, rather than proposals, I would call them patterns.
Recurring themes?
Recurring themes is a good way to say it. One of the recurring themes is confidence in faith. In other words, the confidence that Christ is the one who acts and Christ is the one who calls. That what we're doing is not simply another human enterprise to be done in a frenzy, but rather begins in contemplation and silence and prayer. And I thought that was encouraging. I think a second was not to fear calling forth others to the work of the new evangelization. Bishops, priests, religious, lay faithful, not to be fearful to do that. And I think a third was something you won't be surprised at, and that is the notion of equipping people. That the same reason we talked earlier in this conversation about people being a little fearful about sharing their faith with others is in some ways they haven't been equipped with a language and a way to do that. We know that we are not to impose our faith on others. Jesus himself did not impose himself on others. But how do we propose things in a way that is inviting? And one of the themes that came through is this notion that in the midst of the falling away from church practice, there is a certain level of searching that maybe is built into the human heart. And that they are some of the themes, at least, that I've been listening to.
Now, in your own archdiocese, what kind of measures or plans do you have in sort of concrete terms to reach out maybe to those, as you say, who sort of drifted away from the church, to basically put into act, you know, a new evangelization?
Yes. Well, first of all, people will shriek if they hear me say there's new programs, because it's I've been saying to people that the new evangelization is not a new program. It is a new spirit. It's a new ardor, or I would say enthusiasm, that is important in our faith. Now, we have many opportunities within the Archdiocese of Louisville. We've just completed the first of 4 years of a program called Renew Why Catholic. It is a parish-based small group program based on the Catechism of the Catholic Church, of learning about the faith in small groups and sharing faith. I believe we have about 10,000 people who have participated in one form or another in Why Catholic. That would be an example of something. We don't want to add yet another program. What we'd like to do, though, is make the most of the energy and the openness that people have.
Okay, finally, what would you like to see emerge at the end of this synod? What would you like to see it achieve?
Well, of course, I think someone said, let us go back to that moment in history in which the Lord Jesus called the disciples to go and teach all nations in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I believe he said, I will be with you always, and throughout the pages, do not fear. So my hope will be there will be an enthusiasm, first of all, of valuing our precious faith, of being renewed in our faith, and in a certain humble way in which we convert more deeply into our faith, that we will go forth willing to witness, much like the disciples some 2,000 years ago did.
I was speaking there to Archbishop Joseph Kurtz of Louisville. Another of the synod participants is the Apostolic Administrator of the Archdiocese of Lahore in Pakistan, Bishop Sebastian Shaw. He talked to me about the issue of new evangelization and also commented on the recent shooting of a 14-year-old Pakistani girl by a Taliban gunman because of her campaign for girls' education, and he expressed his support for her mission.
New evangelization is a challenge for all of us, that we are celebrating 50 years of Vatican II. And I think this is helping us to implement the spirit of Vatican II more effectively.
Now, the synod is about halfway through. What have been some of the recurring themes or ideas that have been put across most often?
It is most of us talked about formation of the seminarians, it means future priest, formation of laity, because laity are formed and informed also properly so that they may also take up their role in establishment of the kingdom of God. And also we talk a lot about families, ladies, about families, about young people, about school going children, university students, adults, how we can reach them. Also we realize that maybe in recent past.
Okay. Turning to the situation in Pakistan, how easy is it for the church to carry out its mission there, given that there is strong opposition against, shall we say, non-Muslim people by the Islamic fundamentalists?
You see, new evangelization in Pakistan or in another predominantly Islamic country has a different effect and maybe methodology.
And what is that?
Methodology could be, first of all, we have to establish more or better relationship with the people of other faith. That's one point. So that through our relation, we can help understand what Christianity is, what Christ is. Because many people mixed us up with the European culture. But I feel Christianity is different than the culture. So in this way, some people, even in Pakistan, they think we are ally to maybe European culture or American, but when we are there, we are native from there, from centuries we are living there, so they have also to accept us, we have to accept our realities, and then I think we can work together, and together we can form harmonious society where all Pakistanis can live and profess faith and work for our values like justice, peace and harmony.
But it's not always been easy in Pakistan. You've had, for instance, the killing of the minister for minorities, Shahbaz Bhatti, who was a Catholic, because he spoke out against the blasphemy law. And there have been other cases involving this very controversial law.
There also we have to be quite careful talking about faith of other people. There are laws like blasphemy law is there. So in this way, we have to learn to live in a better way. Maybe when we know that some people is more sensitive to certain things, then we have to respect that.
There's also been the case this month of the 14-year-old girl, Malala Yousafzai, who campaigned for girls' education rights. And the shooting of her, you know, it sparked outrage across the world. It went far beyond Pakistan. What does this incident say about your country, and how has the Catholic Church reacted to it?
It is very sad to hear about Malala. I was already here when I heard it. But I think we have to support all people who are working for the education of people. All people have right to education. All people have right to know their being. All people have right to know their value as a person being and live dignified life. So Malala is a good example that he was teaching, educating. She was educating ladies, especially young ladies, so that ladies, women may know their right in our society in Pakistan. So we support her, and I hope that now many people will support her and her mission will continue.
How would you define the current state of relations between Christians and Muslims?
Actually, in day-to-day life, we live together in a peaceful way. It is true. I mean, in our villages, in cities, they live side by side. And we appreciate living together. Only there are some fundamental movements. They are creating divisions and marginalize some people, politicizing some realities and using for their benefits. Otherwise, day-to-day life, we are working together in offices, in school, in market. People attend marriages, people attend holy festivals.
You have Muslim friends?
Yeah, I have many. From my school time up till now, I have many. I greet them on their feast, they greet me, and we exchange gifts. So I have no problem.
Finally, going back to the synod, what do you hope this synod will achieve?
This synod is a very timely, especially I think for Europe and for all of us who have come from abroad, from other places, to know what we have been doing and actually what we should do now. Because now there is a gap between young, many people and church. So I think we have to find some methodology to bridge the gap and reach people so that people may know Christ and live life with the gospel values.
I was speaking there to Bishop Sebastian Shaw, Apostolic Administrator of Lahore in Pakistan. Here in the Vatican this Sunday, Pope Benedict is set to canonize 7 new saints that include 2 women from North America. They're Blessed Marianne Cope from New York and Kateri Takawitha, the first Native American to become a saint. Marianne Cope was a member of the Sisters of St. Francis of Syracuse, New York, and spent many years caring for lepers on the island of Molokai, Hawaii. She died in 1918. The vice postulator of Blessed Marianne Cope's sainthood cause is Sister Grace Dillon Schneider. She says Mother Marianne is a powerful role model for all women because she never allowed herself to be intimidated by others, and yet she treated everyone with respect.
I think Mother Marianne stands as a role model for women. She was not afraid to speak her piece. She always spoke very respectfully, and she did everything she did, even though she disagreed with people, with respect. But she was never intimidated, and she never let what others thought stop her from trying to do what was best for the people she served. Now, it was a different era, so there were different ways of, you know, things being done. But she stood as a model for all women, I believe, then and now, if you translate it into more modern times, because of the fact that she was not afraid to say what she truly believed. She went ahead and did what she felt was needed. She was deeply religious. She had great faith. One of the things that she insisted upon when she went to Kalapapa was a chapel there. And St. Damien knew she wanted stations, so he gave her stations for the first Christmas that she was there. And they were very poor there. They didn't have money to buy things. They made things. But she I think, her strength as a woman, her respect for others, that led her to always say things that she needed to say respectfully and truthfully, are models of how we need to be now in the church, not to be intimidated, but to respectfully and honestly say what we believe important to say at this time.
Blessed Marianne is also an excellent role model for those who respect life because she cared about the dignity of all people. Sister Dylan Schneider again.
I give talks here and there about Mother Marianne. And as I was talking one time, there was a group of people there from the Respect Life movement. And they were saying how, as they listened to the story of Mother Marianne, and the respect that she had for all people, the care that she took for the dignity of all, and her determination against many difficult odds to do what was best for the people that she was caring for, actually was a very important model for the people who were leading the Respect Life movement in that area. And because she cared for those who were destined to die without care, she really was a model for them, also for the unborn, because of her deep respect for all people and how she lived that out throughout her life. So different people, as they listen to her story at both ends of the Respect Life movement, also see her as a model for them because life was important to her, respect was important to her. So there's many different legacies that she has left, and as mother to the people, she stands as woman to be emulated and from whom people learn. There's not just one facet to Mother Marianne. There's many facets to her, including, you know, that whole idea of evangelization, because it was her faith that led her to do what she did. And every way that she allowed that faith or responded to that faith in her as she cared for others. When there was a crisis among any of the women and children in Kalapapa, she was known to say to the sisters, "Where is your faith? Take the water from Lourdes and pray and have faith." And many times that was all that was necessary for the person to come to peace again, because having that disease, especially as a woman, was a terrible, terrible thing, especially among the children who were taken from their families. It was right around Mother Marianne and St. Bernard that were somewhat contemporaries, but Mother Marianne believed in the power of the water of Lourdes.
That was the vice postulator of Marianne Cope's sainthood cause, Sister Grace Dylan Schneider. She was known as the Lily of the Mohawks because her life was very short and pure, like the flower. Kateri Takawitha was a 17th century Mohawk girl from present-day New York State who became an outcast in her village after she converted to Catholicism. She was forced to flee to a mission in Canada, where she died at the age of 24. The Canadian ambassador to the Holy See is Anne Leahy, and she spoke to us about the importance of the canonization of Blessed Takawitha.
Kateri Takawitha, being recognized by the Catholic Church, is of importance not only to First Nations peoples or to Catholics, because the mere fact of being recognized as such means that she is really put up as a model for the Universal Church, but as a model, in fact, by her life, by her beliefs, by her steadfastness. These are qualities for all individuals, and not only you know, those associated with her, let's say, her immediate background or religion. So in that sense, the government recognizes these qualities and how universal they are. In the press release that the Department of Foreign Affairs just issued announcing the participation of the delegation, the Speaker of the House of Commons mentioned that the story of Kateri Takawitha is an example for all Canadians, and that, in fact, it's an honor that every Canadian can be proud of.
And as you mentioned, of course, soon-to-be Saint Kateri will be the first First Nations member of the First Nations who has been canonized, and in many ways, her life is a meeting place between the First Nations peoples and the peoples of the Old World who had come over and settled in Canada. How do you think that affects relationships between the two different groups?
Well, Kateri is the first North American Indian to be recognized, that's right, as a saint. Her history is the history of the encounter of the first missionaries who were the Jesuits, who came with, at the time that the French came. In all of, in fact, Canada and United States were all New France, on the eastern seaboard. And much has been written and said about this encounter. But this is, in fact, her life embodies the, I think, in many ways, the convergence of the values that her people had in terms of their spirituality, a certain convergence with the Catholic faith that the Jesuits brought.
Very good. Is there anything else you'd like to add on this happy occasion?
Well, I think what I would say is it's an opportunity. Kateri's canonization is bringing together Canadians who belong to the First Nations from across the country. It's amazing to see how groups are coming here on, you know, as pilgrims from Saskatchewan, from Newfoundland, from Ontario and Quebec, of course. And it's an opportunity for us to realize how vivid her story is. I'll tell you a little, I was at the airport just a few hours ago to greet one of our ministers coming in, and at the same time, next door, waiting as well, was the Filipino embassy waiting for the arrival of the vice president for their saint, who's also being canonized, and the wife of the Filipino ambassador came up to me, and she said, "Oh, you're here for Kateri," and I said, "Yes," and she said, "Well, you know, I know about her," and I said, "How's that possible?" And she said, "Well, when I was growing up, you know, back in the in my little village in the Philippines, we had a reader, you know, for English class, and we had a story about Kateri de Kakwitha." So I thought that was quite amazing.
Oh, that's wonderful. Very good. So really, I mean, this is not simply, you know, a celebration of the life of someone who lived hundreds of years ago. It certainly has an impact even today on the lives of people.
I think it does. The fact that she died young, that she was one of the saints or icons that were put forward for the World Youth Day that took place in Toronto in 2002. The fact that, of course, the First Nations are much associated with creation, nature, preservation of the environment, respect for the environment. And Kateri was put forward by John Paul II as a patron, if I could say, of environment and ecology. That makes her still, I think, quite modern, actually.
That was Canada's ambassador to the Holy See, Anne Leahy, speaking to Christopher Wells. Canadian Bishop Brian Dunn of Antigonish, Nova Scotia, speaks about the great joy and excitement triggered by this upcoming canonization.
For the Canadian Church, we have a large delegation here, about 1,500 pilgrims who are coming over for the canonization. In my own diocese, we have 8,000 Mi'kmaq, and so those are First Nations people. And we have about 50 or 60 people who are coming as well. This is a very important aspect, and the way I consider my own diocese is that a number of groups of people that really color the texture of the diocese, including Scottish people. Some of those first Scottish people came over, and they really give a sense of the diocese. We have some French, we have the Mi'kmaq, and so I think the Mi'kmaq is a really sometimes a group of people that are isolated, and so this will bring them into the heart of the church.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English program. But we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programs on the internet at www.radiovaticana.va. Laudato Jesus Christus.